Many of you sat the Sesshin only a Buddha and a Buddha Sesshin. You did, and did you come for any of this?
The last Sunday.
Yeah. And I wasn't able to make the last Sunday, but I was here for one of the services where it was chanted. The entire universe is the eye of Vairochana. It means that Buddhas have a single eye. Do not suppose that the Buddha's eye is like the human eyes. So the Vairochana Buddha is the Buddha of sunyata, of emptiness. His partner is the white Tara, the female Tara. And of course, emptiness is, codependent origination. Some people use that term. Interdependent origination, dependent co-arising, and in this text it was non-substantiality. And it was really helpful to me to consider that for a moment, that the universe is a single eye, because then it can't exclude anything. No matter what you like or what you really dislike, it's like you gotta eat it all. I studied with Katagiri Roshi, and Michael did too, and for a little bit, and I was really fortunate to run into him. I moved to Minneapolis in 1974, and happened to move to a house that was a couple of doors away from him. And somebody in our house said, "You want to go hear a Zen master talk?" And I said, "Well, sure. Let me take some LSD and go hear him." And
did you take LSD?
Not while during a talk, but I've taken enough of that stuff. So, but it was, you go start sitting and you wonder what are we doing here, and when Katagiri would talk about emptiness, he would say, "Just this it is." And would Koban say anything like that?
Is that the way you said it? Just this?
Just this it is.
Kind of not quite correct English, but interesting.
Yeah.
Just this it is.
Another way to look at it is, this is it. Just this. So ordinarily, we look at our day and say, same stuff, different day. We go about our business and take care of it. And then somebody says, "Hey, you know, life is really special." It seems like with ordinary mind, nothing special. Why be surprised when everything's a surprise? Or amazing, everything is amazing, or everything is alive. But why not be surprised when everything's a surprise? Why whether it's a dust mite or a thunderbolt or an eclipse. So coming to sit helps us probably appreciate the amazing in the ordinary. I think everybody here has sat sesshins and realized what a unique opportunity they are, and it's and we get to meet ourselves when we face the wall, and at first we wonder all the stuff that's coming up when we meditate, just like really surprised at what it is that is there. And it really helps us watch our thoughts and our tendencies and our inclinations, notice our preferences, and they can be quite hard. A friend of mine, L. Tribe, he and his wife studied with Sojin Roshi Mel Weitzman. And he told of his wife Fran sitting her first sesshin and going to Dokusan with Suzuki Roshi. And this was probably 1968 or 69. And she said, "I don't belong here. This is really hard." And he responded, Suzuki Roshi responded, "You may leave." "But you have no place to go." So back to the ordinary mind. Yesterday was just grunt work, you know, digging holes up at the road.
By the way, if I could inject, when you came in, did you see the new sign?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Did you see the new sign? You didn't notice it?
There was a bicyclist right in the way, so I saw a bicyclist.
Yes, I did, and I commented on it. Brian, it was just striking.
Yeah.
And very vibrant.
Yeah.
So Doug and Brian.
And the boy, the other boys, the other four, you know, we finished digging it out and pouring the concrete. And but while up there, you know, there was
the old one better, though.
What's that?
I like the old one better.
The old sign?
Too fussy.
But it's vibrant.
It's illegal.
Both of them?
The old sign?
Both signs. We need approval from the County of Santa Cruz and from Open Space and probably Caltrans too to put up a sign, and we didn't bother. So,
how did you find out?
We're all lost up here.
How was it found out that it was illegal?
Well, nobody said anything yet, but we're just conjecturing that it's illegal. But it goes with this place quite well. At times feeling like outlaws, at other times, you know, we live by the law, all the laws that permeate. And we get to witness a lot of outlaw behavior too, even up at the road. There's motorcyclists going by at 90 miles an hour. One of them popped a wheelie up the straightaway, and cars racing down the straightaway just with maybe 15 feet between them. And it's just, you know, really something. But the signs off the road, I think it could stay there for quite a while. and be safe. So all that work going into making the sign, this guy Montgomery made the sign. He also makes shogohatsus, the bamboo flutes. And all the other work that went into it, a lot of heartbeats going. And with each heartbeat, it's a brand new heartbeat. It's totally unique. The electrical impulse that makes the heart pump and suck. I think it sucks blood and pumps blood. Just every heartbeat of her life is totally unique. With the blood, different configurations of blood cells every beat. And we have probably as many heartbeats in our life as we there are seconds in our life. It's close, right? Unless you're running a lot, and you might have twice as many heartbeats in your life. Or maybe, yeah, even if you die young, you've used up the number of heartbeats you get. And I was reading from Mark 8-10. It happens to be a compilation put together by Judy Kosko on Koban's talking about the Heart Sutra. And the title of the document is Mark 8-10. And I thought, sounds biblical. And in it, he talks about the mantra we just chanted, the Heart Sutra. Gate, gate, para gate. That it's like our heartbeat. Had any of you heard that or thought of that before?
Koban said that?
Yeah.
And it says gone, gone. So each moment.
Mm-hmm. So I thought that's a good reason to call it the Heart Sutra. Not only that, it's the essential nut, the heart of the matter, but useful to think about our heartbeat. And so sometimes as I drive the highway, maybe you all think like this too from time to time, as like highway Interstate 280 is so beautiful. And you see all the other cars on the road, and there are times where somebody's passing in and out, and other times where somebody is obstructing the flow, little arterial sclerosis in the pathway. And other times where it's just amazingly uniform and generous, even though everybody's moving fast. There's a generosity about it. There's a harmony about it. Feel like a corpuscle on this artery. And within each car is someone, at least one, I hope at least one, with a beating heart, with their blood flowing through their bodies. And it's just like, wow, this is, we're all going in the same direction. Is there something useful about this? We're all going different places, and people get off different minor arteries, peel off different streets, just like blood cells go to different zones of the body. They go home to get nurtured, so I can get back on the highway again. I don't know if there's a spiritual practice of driving yet. Maybe with electric cars. But I can imagine it's only a matter of time before there's a whole spirituality of driving.
Steve Stuckey talked about that. He has driving, the four foundations of mindful driving. He talked about it in one of his talks. It's mindfulness of the road, mindfulness of the vehicle, mindfulness of other drivers, and mindfulness of yourself. And then he talked about trying to do this, and then someone cut right in front of him. he lost it being angry at this person.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, you're driving, and sometimes it's all harmonious, and other times, you know, drivers can be spacey because they're on the phone, or they're angry, and they're texting, or they're angry, and they've got an agenda, they're pushing, or that they're actually defining their position in this matter, and I'm going 60 and I'm not going to go 61, and if you're behind me you can pass me if you want, but I'm not going any faster. Or you're on a really heavy load and it's like you have to go the rate you're going because you're protecting the mass that you carry. A lot of times, you know, we can go through all of these states of mind that I just said within less than 5 minutes, from being harmonious to being angry to defining our position. And so it's a great opportunity to see how we are. Yes?
I just wanted to share that Coben once said in a lecture I heard that driving was like everything was flowing through him. Whole thing just flowing through.
Mm-hmm.
Different kind of mindfulness, maybe.
Mm-hmm. We become very law-abiding very quickly when we see the black and white, the CHP. Yes, very law-abiding. So the one eye of the universe includes all that we discern, all that we like, all that we dislike, all our preferences. And tendencies. So how do remember the one eye? I'm going to read this Walt Whitman poem called All Is Truth. Walt Whitman, I think he was born in early 1800s. He was an old man when the photography came about, but that was almost 200 years ago that he was born. And in his poem All Is Truth, he says, "O me, man of lack in faith so long, standing aloof, denying portions so long, only aware today of compact, undiffused truth." Compact, undiffused truth. Which might be the one eye of the universe. Discovering today there is no lie or form of lie, and can be none, but grows as inevitably upon itself as the truth does upon itself. Discovering today there is no lie or form of lie, and can be none. That there is no lie and can be, or form of lie and can be none. I think that's interesting. I don't know. I'll have a question afterwards. Or as any law of the earth or any natural production of the earth does. This is curious and may not be realized immediately, but it must be realized. I feel myself that I represent falsehoods equally with the rest, and that the universe does. I feel myself that I represent falsehoods equally with the rest, and that the universe does. Meditating among liars, here we are, and retreating sternly into myself, I see that there are really no liars or lies after all, and that nothing fails its perfect return, and that what are called lies are perfect returns, and that each thing exactly represents itself and what has preceded it, and that the truth includes all and is compact, just as much as space is compact, and that there is no flaw or vacuum in the amount of truth, but that all is truth without exception. And henceforth I will go celebrate anything I see or am, and sing and laugh and deny nothing. He says that there is no flaw or vacuum in the amount of truth. And it sounds like the Dharma is boundless. Yeah. Or there is no increase or decrease. There is no flaw or vacuum in the amount of the truth. But anyway, I meditating among liars, I thought that was an interesting. Grace Shearson, the abbess of Emptiness Sendo, she said in Japan, Roshi is... means a bald-headed scoundrel, unless proved otherwise. And I don't know, from your experience, Ken, is Roshi a term that you'd heard used growing up?
No. I think that's a kind of Buddhism word.
Pardon me?
Buddhism word, not the general word, Japanese.
It's a what word?
Buddhism.
Buddhism or religious special term, Roshi.
And you did grow up hearing it?
No.
Okay.
Roshi, for those of you, do you know the meaning of Roshi?
No.
Maybe you could. Roshi is... a title for a teacher, for usually a senior teacher, might be called Roshi. She is my Roshi is high teacher or elevated teacher. It's Roshi.
She's Japanese.
It's Japanese, yeah. And the connotation, like Doug mentioned, is it's an honorific term. It's a very honorific term of someone who's who's a teacher in their own right, or a teacher that has had lots of experience or guides others. But it has a connotation in Japan of being kind of over the hill a little bit, or a little kind of lost it a little bit, maybe, you know. So it's it can be used both ways. It can be used as a very honorific term and also as a slightly, what did you say, bald-headed what?
Scoundrel. Bald-headed scoundrel. And that a lot of times, you know, when you're in a position of authority and power, you get away with a lot. And so just because you advance to that position doesn't mean that. And for example, here at Jokoji, it's a fairly democratic community, but we all know who's in charge. Michael.
I didn't know that.
See? And since he doesn't know it, he doesn't kind of push us to, hey, we got to remember who's in charge. I mean, it's like, the chickens are in charge, or the kale's in charge today. So it's really nice to have that not as the dominant mechanism, but when you go to Tassajara, I mean, there's a real hierarchy there. And when there are that 100 people, it needs to be that way to function properly.
Perhaps.
Yes?
Perhaps it has to function that way. This seems historical. And something, because it's traditional and historical and conventional, you can hang on to it. And it reminds me of a class I took in theory of art history. And art history is, for the longest time, is based kind of like in a line. And people, critics, historians, it was talked about in the class, say, well, this person is connected to this other person, and that's why that person evolved from this other person's work or ideas. So it goes in a line, and it makes it easier to understand and to support itself. But the notion was that that's one approach, and that in that approach, all these other tributaries are denied, and maybe it isn't a straight line.
That's in describing the history that it's denied, right?
Well, I'm using it, or I'm trying to use it as an analogy to. You said in Tassajara there's a hierarchy there, and it needs to be because there's 100 people, something like that. And then I said, perhaps it has to be that way. Just throwing out that maybe it seems to be, it has to be that way. I guess the word has to is what I felt. Maybe this is part of something that could be looked at a little more closely. To have a democracy and a leader, as you said here, what's a democracy without a leader? What does that look like?
There are still roles that, right? There are roles that need to be played out.
Need to be.
Like cook, like work leader, like head teacher, like zendo cleaner.
I guess what I'm getting to is that I am reside in, thrive almost, I want to say, in order. Bow to the Zafu, turn to the right. Well, these are structures that allow my mind, I suppose, to rest, to have anchor, security, in a way.
Mm-hmm. In the form. Yeah. Uh-huh.
But in that staring at the wall, it allows the form kind of to dissipate and reveal something more.
Beyond form.
So it's an interesting sense, you know, you have one thing that has order allowing for something else that isn't mm-hmm. like that in a way, or, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like talking. This, which is a facsimile of the experience, and it makes it tight, and we can talk about it. But mm-hmm. is it truth, or what is truth? Yeah. Yeah.
Let me, you know, Walt Whitman says we're meditating among liars, and I have a cousin. She gets really angry and just, my father is such a liar, and just slams him. But fundamentally, maybe there are no lies. Mm-hmm. They're just perspectives. Mm-hmm. So how do you hold on to truth or shun lies when they all are manifestations of a situation with conditions? It's a lie might be expressed from a certain, it might be a lie from a certain person's perspective, but from that person who's maybe stating a lie, there are things they can't face. They can't see. They don't want anybody to know, even though it's all visible. They don't. So they lie because they can't face their reality. And yet that lie, that manifestation, is a full embodiment of the truth of that person.
At that time.
At that time.
Mm-hmm.
So you can hear a person lie, and if you see, instead of just hearing the words and having the words be the data that goes into your brain and says, oh, they're saying this, so I believe them. Or, oh, wait, he's wrong, he's not telling the truth, he's a damn liar. But after, you know, living with that for a bit, you can say, he's expressing his truth. And now I know that that's his truth. Right now. So, next time he says something, do you say, he's a liar? Or do you hear what he says and penetrate what he's saying and see what his truth is at that point?
Kind of meet him where he is.
Mm-hmm.
What, but then what's a lie? What does that mean?
Not speaking the truth. What is true, but it might be in the context of what a certain person's perspective, that it's a lie.
Anyway, lunch.
Yeah, lunch is call.
One more?
Well, this is a great topic. I wanted to get back a little bit back towards the organizational kind of model that you were talking about with Tulsa Heart. Henry David Thoreau, who kind of was known to kind of chafe at the at what was supposed to be, you know, he lived a life of contemplation and so on, Walden Pond. He said that any fool can make a rule or a law, and any fool will follow it. I thought I'd add that to the discussion. So, and I seem to see that in the news every day. There's another law, there's another bill, there's a...
There's a perspective of looking at lies, at what we call lies, is actually in a sort of absolute sense, in the sense of that one eye of Vairochana, the one universal eye, that you could say, and I think that addresses your question, or what the question that came up, is actually you can't. There's no lie. You can't lie. You even in the act of trying to lie, you'll reveal the truth of you attempting to hide the truth, and that's the truth. Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful truth. I mean, wonderful. It's a revealed truth.
So in other words, everything's truth.
Everything is absolutely revealed. There's no hidden fist of the Buddhist teaching. There's no esoteric. Everything's revealed. It's just a question of whether we are able to. We're ready to meet it. Yeah, which is what you're talking about. Yeah.
I mean, there's still delusion.
Better the way you say it.
Yeah. So. Thank you.
There's still delusion. Coming back to it.
I mean, if there are no lies, does that mean there is no delusion? But I like how you phrase that. That's great. Yeah.